Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Tomorrow is the Feast of St. Joseph. All throughout March, you can pick up a copy of Father Donald Calloway's Consecration to St. Joseph from EWTN Publishing. In this great book, Father Donald calls on us to turn to St. Joseph, to entrust ourselves to our spiritual father's loving care. And so purchase a copy, and each purchase will include a free DVD of EWTN Live with Father Calloway and Father Mitch Pacwa. Pick up your copy at EWTNRC.com. Now, we're going to open this hour by speaking with my friend Andrea Picciotti-Bear. For her, raising daughters in today's culture has reinforced a lesson that no policy document will be able to capture, that girls flourish when they are known, loved, and accompanied by the people closest to them. And yes, many of you are listening going, you don't say, but the fact that this very salient truth needs to be restated as if it is novel in and of itself makes it an important thing to address. No school counselor, no government agency, no ideology can replace the presence of an attentive and loving parent. And so Andrea unpacks this for us. After that, I want to talk about Trisomy 18 Awareness Day, which is today. Obviously, I want to talk about the value of the human person. I want to talk about the fact that I was just in Taiwan and the kind of prevalent Chinese and Eastern concept of the dignity of human life, of the child in the womb, how here in the U.S. we have a similar concept that's permeating the culture despite our very clear Christian heritage that we take for granted. And I also want to juxtapose this with the death of someone who caused a tremendous amount of damage to the global society, and that's Paul Ehrlich. He's the author of The Population Bomb. I want to talk about how his thought process actually influenced my own education in childhood and how it fed the narrative for the population control nonsense that we're seeing in the world today that's doing us way more harm than good. And then finally, we're going to speak with my friend Pat Flynn about what theist and atheist actually mean. There's an assumption commonly shared on both sides of this debate that's a major obstacle to dialogue, the misconception that all theists believe in basically the same thing. So we need to unpack all of that. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, March 18th. It's the Feast of St. Cyril of Jerusalem. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. The war in Iran is set to enter its third week. It comes as Iran confirming its intelligence minister was killed by an Israeli strike last night, and comes a day after top Iranian officials were killed by Israel. Meanwhile, gas prices continue to rise, and there's still no clear word on which nations, if any, will help the U.S. bring the situation in the Strait of Hormuz under control. President Trump's pick to replace Kristi Noem as the Department of Homeland Security chief appeared before lawmakers today. Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma testified before the Senate Homeland Security Committee for his confirmation hearing. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul says he won't support Mullen's nomination.
You told the media that I was a freaking snake and that you completely understood why I had been assaulted.
I can understand why the neighbor did what he did.
Paul cited Mullen's alleged inability to apologize and past remarks he made relating to Paul's 2017 attack as the reason for his opposition. Notre Dame will begin to offer free tuition to some students next school year. Most students from families with annual income below $60,000 will receive need-based financial aid that covers tuition, fees, housing, and food. The initiative will also benefit students whose family have an annual income below $150,000, as they'll receive need-based financial aid that covers the cost of tuition. And the Federal Reserve is leaving interest rates unchanged. It's the second time in a row the Fed has kept rates steady. It comes as the central bank navigates through some economic uncertainty that's been created by the Iran war. Wall Street is closing with stocks sharply lower, with the three major indexes down more than 1%. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Parental rights, the cornerstone of American law. For Andrea Picciotti-Bayer, who joins us today, raising daughters in today's culture has reinforced a lesson that no policy document will capture. Girls flourish when they are known, loved, and accompanied by the people closest to them, in this case especially the presence of an attentive and loving parent. Andrea is legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. Follow her work at conscience-project.org. Andrea, thank you very much for joining us again. How are you?
I'm doing great, Marcus. How are you?
I'm well. I'm still reflecting on my time in Taiwan, and maybe you and I ought to connect about that sometime in the future. But I'm really glad for this piece that you've penned in the National Catholic Register about parental rights. And I know I'm going to start with an extremely broad concept here, but I'd like to invite you to speak to how central the concept of parental rights are to the American way of life.
Where to begin? Right. I mean, we know as Catholics, and the Church has taught that parents are the primary educators of our children. And so if we think about education as building up a good and effective citizenry, well, it really falls primarily on parents to be able to do that. So that's a really important contribution that we make to the common good and to our neighbors and to, you know, our country as a whole. We also realize that this is a delicate time that we're living in. You know, there are all sorts of ideologies that are challenging the very nature of what it means to be human, male, female, the nature of the dignity of life. And so the role of parents in both modeling love and creating a community of support and encouragement are some of the greatest antidotes to the culture of death and the gender confusion that we see many of our young people struggling with.
Now, let's talk about the fact that the more the state overreaches in the life of a child, the more confused the child becomes in terms of their own humanity.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if that's just a structural problem. It probably is, in that God, you know, didn't just have babies, you know, come out of thin air, but gave them to a family. You know, and we understand the importance of the home as a domestic church. But it surely does seem that in modern times, when the state has gotten control over the raising of young people, whether it's in a communist or a socialist state, or even a very large administrative state, oftentimes we lack the nuance and the love and the perception that people have when they're the ones that have been raising a child since their birth or their adoption, and really can pay attention to when there's a need for someone to push, to hold back, or just to sit with someone. The state really just can never be a substitute for a loving parent.
Every single time we have seen the state attempt to take over the role of a parent, we've seen a continued denigration in not just the dignity of the human person, but frankly, the way society considers the value of human life. Can you also speak to that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, the two kind of concepts that come to mind are the attempts to eliminate the parent's role when a minor, especially, mm-hmm. is expecting a child, and to exclude parents and instead force abortion on a young pregnant woman. You know, we've seen so many people struggling with post-abortion regret and just, you know, the child itself not being brought forth to life. But we're also looking at gender ideology, which is almost trying to replace the family with an ideology, you know, oftentimes under the guise of a quote unquote glitter family. For a child that's struggling with her own development and her own identity, having a bunch of strangers, often online and with the state's support, giving encouragement to something that isn't going to solve the mental health or the wounds that someone has, but instead create more. And we've heard time and time again with these young detransitioners, young women especially, who were pursuing gender transition and now are kind of taking that U-turn back to their biological reality. And oftentimes it was coming home again that brought them profound peace, not that kind of severing that the state oftentimes was sanctioning or enforcing.
You and I have spoken about Mirabelli versus Bonta, Mahmoud versus Taylor. So we're seeing that this present Supreme Court is starting to regain a proper interpretation of the Constitution and the intent of our founders and the central place of parents as bedrocks for the formation of children in society.
No, absolutely. I mean, I can't say more than I can about how great the Supreme Court is. I also, you know, want to give a shout out to the people in the Trump administration, especially the Department of Health and Human Services, for walking back a lot of policies that were pushed forward in the Biden administration and at the Department of Education as well, to kind of force gender ideology into our school systems, into our healthcare systems, into our homes. And Supreme Court is really looking at the constitutional protections of the right to free speech and the right to religious exercise, the free exercise of religion, and Catholic and other Christian and other faith oriented families have been the ones to bring those cases to the court. The court can't act on their own accord. It's only when a case or controversy is before it. And there have been some pretty brave parents that aren't willing to see their children be turned around in such a dark way, and instead are pointing to their faith and pointing to the love that they have for their children to kind of walk with them through confusion and their right and entitlement to be part of the conversation.
In that light, can I also invite you to speak to the fact that we've had in recent decades presidencies and administrations that have facilitated tremendous overreach of the state on the role of parents in their fundamental right to parent their children?
You know, absolutely. It's, you know, unfortunately, abuse does happen. Mm-hmm. Child abuse does happen. But that cannot be a cover or an excuse for the kind of overreach that we are seeing with regard to parental rights, especially when it comes to abortion and gender ideology. Our assumption should be that the home is a loving and safe home. Obviously, if there's any indication of abuse, we need to be protecting the child and helping the family to reestablish those important bonds if possible, or to get a safe and secure home for a child. But that can't be our starting place. And that's where some of these policies really were beginning. The idea that parents were somehow a threat, and they were selling that idea to confused kids, that they were really not to trust their parents and instead trust the state policies to keep things, you know, sensitive issues secret from their parents, instead of really sharing with the people who really know them best that they're having difficulties. And we know time and time again as parents that the more information we have, the better we can help. And that really should be what the government is supporting, is enabling parents to be the help that kids need, especially in times of distress and worry.
In light of all of this, then, as we move forward, all of our listeners, I want to invite you to speak to them, not just as a legal analyst, but also as a parent, to take seriously this God-given right, and also this right that the state cannot encroach upon, for involvement in their child's formation.
No, absolutely. I've said it before, you know, an exercise is a right, is just like a muscle. If you don't exercise it, it's going to atrophy. Mm. And so we need to be attentive to our children's needs, partnering with institutions, whether they be schools or doctors. And if those schools or doctors aren't willing to partner with us and are keeping information, then we need to leave and find a better support system. And we're seeing more and more that happen. So I think that the future is bright, but we have to be on our guard.
You know, I'm really glad to hear you say that. In fact, I think that quote ought to go on a T-shirt. A right is like a muscle. Don't exercise and it's going to atrophy. Thank you so much, Andrea, for your time.
Thanks, Marcus. Have a lovely afternoon.
You too. My guest has been Andrew Pejoti-Bear. We've been talking about not just legal, but also theological realities of parental rights over children. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hey, Catholic parents, could you use a break? Parenting is hard, especially at this time of year, and burnout can steal the joy right out of family life.
Join us, Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak, on Wednesday, March 18th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern for a free webinar sponsored by Ave Maria Radio titled Reclaiming the Joy of Parenting, Overcoming Burnout.
Discover practical, faith-filled ways to recharge your batteries and reclaim the joy of parenting. Register today at AveMariaRadio.net. Don't miss it. Your family's worth it.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. March 18th, 3/18, is Trisomy 18 Awareness Day, 3/18. It's also called Edwards Syndrome. It involves an extra copy of chromosome 18. And March 18 was chosen precisely because of that genetic pattern. The deeper issue I want to highlight about today, though, is that children with trisomy 18, Down syndrome, and other chromosomal variants have too often been discussed in public life, public policies, and frankly, global conversation, through the language of things like burden and cost and strain and inconvenience. I'd like to juxtapose this event, then, with the fact that Paul Ehrlich, the infamous author of The Population Bomb, he died on March the 13th. He was 93 years old. His ideas helped furnish the moral grammar for that entire way of thinking. The Christian and natural law vision teaches that man is created in the image of God. The Catechism teaches that human dignity is rooted in the divine image. Scripture calls children a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. The worth of a child doesn't rise and fall with lifespan or ability or even social convenience. A child with an extra chromosome has the exact same ontological dignity as the valedictorian, the Olympic athlete, the Nobel laureate, the finance executive who imagines himself indispensable. Well, that child may actually carry greater moral significance for our society because he exposes to us whether our society still recognizes human dignity as intrinsic. Modern prenatal culture, unfortunately, has been moving steadily in the opposite direction. This is the global culture. Iceland cited an above 85% screening and close to terminating 100% of pregnancies of Down syndrome and other genetic issues discovered in the womb. Denmark, they report termination rates at about 98% after prenatal diagnosis. Earlier reporting on Danish screening actually shows a dramatic fall in births of children with Down syndrome and things like trisomy 18 after national screening protocols were greatly expanded. In other words, in global medical language right now, some children are basically being told they are unwelcome long before they can draw their first breath. This is eugenics. There's no way around it. This is eugenics. China, I just got back from Taiwan, and Chinese culture and philosophical thinking permeates the Taiwanese culture to a large degree. And China's even harsher as a case study, because demographic engineering there has been tied to things like state priorities. There's a culture of son preference and birth quality concerns. Recent research on China's birth defect prevention regime shows that they had a strategy, carrier screening, prenatal screening, intervention, and there were real ethical concerns around their policy environment. But simply put, China to this day wrestles with a distorted sex ratio at birth. The son preference still endures, so much so that you've got too many men and too few women who are of marriage age. And so China is going to greatly suffer a population crisis in the next 1.5 generations. Scholarly work on their two-child transition found that the older 1.5-child regime intensified that imbalance. In all those atmospheres, a child with a disability like trisomy 18 or Down syndrome had very little cultural leverage. They were frankly murdered after birth because the combined pressures of things like state planning, family expectations, social stigma meant that they couldn't risk it. If you only have the quote-unquote right to have one or two children, you want every one of them to be as productive as possible. In steps one of the fathers of this paradigm. He was his work was awful. His name is Paul Ehrlich. In The Population Bomb, Ehrlich opened with a sentence: "The battle to feed all of humanity is over." He warned us that in the 1970s and 80s, hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death. And then he argued that society must have population control at home, hopefully through changes in our value system, and by that he meant stop valuing the family. And then he says, but by compulsion, if voluntary methods fail, which means stop valuing marriage and the family, and if the families don't listen, governments force them to stop having children. In fact, one paperback slogan of his book summarizes his entire creed in 6 words: population control or the race to oblivion. As if kill your children or the human race will cease to exist. That's exactly what he was saying. Ehrlich's intellectual lineage runs through, you've got people like Thomas Malthus, and you've got these neo-Malthusian writers, you know, Fairfield Osborne, William Vogt. Their books in 1948 ignited this mid-century panic about population and limited resources. The central error in that tradition is that it rejects the Judeo-Christian conviction that man bears the image of God. It rejects the natural law insight that the human person is an end in himself. Once you surrender that premise, every ugly policy begins to look reasonable. And so forced sterilization, abortion, disability, all of these things just become tandem to the conversation of the human person. Children are described as emission producers. I remember living in California, and one of my colleagues was inviting his 6th child into the world, and we were all rejoicing for him. And another colleague, completely avowed progressivist in mentality, said, "Wow, you really don't care about the environment having so many children." That's an Ehrlichian way of thinking. Because Ehrlich, for all of his predictions, he actually proved spectacularly wrong on the empirical side. And I mean spectacularly. The Green Revolution sharply increased agricultural output. Global food productions rose dramatically. Commodity prices in the... Paul Ehrlich had a wager with Julian Simon. And so they made a wager. Ehrlich predicted that because of the limitation of resources, resources would rise to alarming rates. In fact, the prices of resources fell: chromium, copper, nickel, tin, and tungsten. So much so that newer work on superabundance argues that over long stretches, growing populations can coincide with greater resource accessibility because human creativity changes the economic picture. In other words, yes, people are consumers, but they're also producers, they're inventors, they're builders, they're laborers, they're discoverers, they're problem solvers, they're policymakers. A baby grows up to become a scientist, an engineer, a laborer, a nurse, entrepreneur, farmer, teacher, mother, priest, craftsman, what have you. And that's why Paul Ehrlich simply didn't fathom the value of the human person that was so necessary in this conversation. Now, there were other thinkers that exposed him. Julian Simon was one of them. You also had, I'm going to mention some of these names, Esther Bozerop, Amartya Sen. But the point I want to stress is that Paul Ehrlich was so popular that in my empirical science education, his worldview was what we were taught, that population control was the way to go. And so you've got a development of what we call sentimental environmentalism. My friend Wes Smith of the Discovery Institute talks with me on my program about that topic constantly. The emotional script is familiar. If human beings are the problem, stop reproducing, stop having human children, save the planet, save the forest, save the river, save the human species. Now, sure, you can have a legitimate moral concern there. We need to steward our resources well. But now the push is neo-paganism, that nature has more rights than man. Man is the problem. The way forward is refreshingly plain. Societies need more children. We simply cannot survive. We become the authors of our own economic demise and social and cultural and political demise as well. Societies need more children. We need stronger marriages, stable homes, affordable housing, sane taxation, family wages, maternal and paternal support, and a public ethic that welcomes every life in the womb rather than screening it away. Scripture calls children a gift. Natural law confirms a civilization renews itself through families. So yes, that child in the womb could well become the arbiter and the designer of the innovation that transforms the trajectory of human history. So no, Paul Ehrlich was wrong. The child in the womb, or the child with the extra chromosome, is never the crisis. The real crisis lives in the society that has forgotten how invaluable a child really is. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization. Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
St. John Bosco once had a heavenly vision telling him to reject harsh approaches to discipline and instead raise the children in his care with reason, religion, and loving kindness. Today, we call his method discipleship discipline. It's a means of child rearing that doesn't just focus on stopping bad behavior, but rather helps parents raise faithful kids who love God and lead virtuous Christian lives. Discipleship discipline is great for kids, but it also helps parents experience and share God's love more effectively with their families. That's why discipleship discipline is such an important part of the liturgy of domestic church life, a way of experiencing the faith as the source of the warmth in your home. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
I tell oftentimes an experience that I had at Divine Child when I was a young priest, 1 year ordained. First time I ever really saw the power of the Blessed Sacrament. And we simply exposed the Blessed Sacrament at the end of Mass one night. I encouraged people. I said, you know what? We've been in the habit of praying over people after Mass. I said, we're not going to do that this week. I'm just going to invite people to come on up and pray if they want to pray. And I put the Blessed Sacrament on the altar. I kneeled down. As I kneeled down, the church is in the sanctuary, the whole church. And as I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the people there, and I'm looking at Jesus under the appearance of bread there, I saw the Lord standing on the altar. And he's just standing there looking out at all the people. And then at a certain point, he turned towards me, and he just bowed. And he says, don't you see how easy this is? You don't have to do anything. You just have to put me out. You put me out, and I will work.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. In numerous conversations between atheists and theists, one of the issues is that there's an assumption commonly shared on both sides that all theists believe in basically the same thing and that all atheists don't believe or believe in basically the same thing as well. The problem is the terms themselves are so widespread that we have to seriously engage the phenomena of atheism and theism on its merits and to discuss what that kind of dialogue can actually look like. Joining me to have a conversation about this is my friend Pat Flynn, writer, philosopher, podcaster, and speaker. He lives in Wisconsin with his bride, five children, and his St. Bernard. He hosts Philosophy for the People and The Pat Flynn Show, and his website is chroniclesofstrength.com. Pat, great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm great, Marcus. Always a pleasure to be with you. How are you?
Likewise. Every time I know you're coming on, it's a treat for me. So, as a former atheist, I think I'll be one of the first to admit that I think every atheist believes that they have their own brand of atheism. And so that logic would apply on the theistic sphere as well. Can you please speak to that in a general perspective?
Yeah, so I think today's conversation is based off a brief Substack article I put up on the importance of not assuming more than you reasonably should of the opposing view in this context. If you're a theist, assuming certain things of atheists, or if you're an atheist, assuming certain things of theists. And it does work certainly both ways. But just to get to my motivation here, as somebody who was formerly an atheist and now is decidedly in camp theism, it's annoying, right? It's annoying when people consistently tell you you believe things that you don't. And for me and my purposes, which are not just philosophical but evangelical and apologetic, I think it's really important to do everything you can to not annoy somebody. Because when you constantly tell people that they're wrong because they believe X, Y, or Z, and they don't believe any of those things, the chances of having an actual productive dialogue with them, of having a fruitful exchange, and maybe even getting them to open up to your position, significantly decrease. So this sort of branches out from a wider theme I've talked about before in apologetics of a division between the matter and the manner. You know, there's the matter of the content. You want to make sure that what you say is strong and correct and all this or that. But there's also the manner of how you approach people, how you engage people, being charitable, being gentle, being patient, and also making sure that you take the time to understand what their position is. So just to give you an idea, that's a little bit of my motivation behind what's going on with this article and conversation today, Marcus.
Mm-hmm. Understanding that motivation gives us the context we need to go forward, because you highlight an extremely crucial component of, in this case, I guess we can call it interreligious and a-religious dialogue, because I don't want to cast aspersions on the Catholic enterprise of evangelization, but I do believe we do a rather poor job of trying to properly intellectually understand the motivations and the frameworks, the categories of the person we're trying to evangelize. We often come with the fact that we have the fullness of truth without knowing what the categories we are actually speaking to actually say.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think we need to take responsibility for that. But of course, I also don't want to make it at all seem like this is a problem exclusive to Catholics. I mean, you see it all over the place. I mean, Protestants make assumptions about Catholic beliefs that they constantly critique that are wrong. Atheists make assumptions about theistic beliefs that are frequently wrong and not even in the general direction of anything that is actually held by theists. So, and you see this go on in political spheres as well. So I think it's a very general tendency. And I think it's sort of just born out of the fact that people tend to kind of live in their own circles and they don't, you know, for whatever reason, often linked to motivated reasoning, they're not very comfortable going out of those circles and understanding different positions and having their ideas or positions challenged. And I don't think it's everyone's duty to go out and try to understand every opposing viewpoint. I think that that's asking too much. But I think it is a duty that if you're going to go out and critique, that you at least then have spent the time trying to understand the position that it is that you're venturing out to make various criticisms of.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk then about some general structures that you have discovered. So we're operating here from the premise of you and I being faithful Catholics, in this case, Catholic apologists. But let's begin there when we're talking about dialogue with atheism.
Yes. Yeah, good. So I think this conversation will be a lot more practical if we start with some sort of everyday examples. Mm-hmm. And here's a really common one, and this is we'll start on the theistic side of making assumptions that aren't often helpful. And one is that when theists or religious people go to critique atheists, they often start off by assuming that the atheist is a nihilist, right? That they have no morality in their worldview or that they can't explain morality or something like that. Now, here I want to make an important distinction. I think it is one thing to venture an argument to show that the various systems of atheism have a hard time and a difficult time securing various features of the moral dimension. I, in fact, myself have tried to endeavor to make such arguments. But that's different than just making an assumption, because the truth is many, many atheists are not nihilists. Mm-hmm. Most of them, would hold to some very robust form of what's called a moral realism. And they're frankly very offended when you assume that they're nihilists, either in a philosophical or practical sense. So right away, that tends to start things off on poor footing. I'm sure you've seen that example, Marcus, right? A fairly common one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And therein lies perhaps the issue that because it is a fairly common one, we ought to approach it with a sense of intellectual honesty and, dare I say, a little bit of compassion for those who have arrived there intellectually.
And not only that, but two more points there. I think one way to foster better conversations is rather than starting with an attack based on an assumption that may be entirely incorrect, start a conversation just by asking a question. You know, if you're unsure, ask the atheist what their positions mm-hmm. are on various things, whether it's morality, if they do affirm a sort of moral dimension, and if so, how they think that is ultimately secured or explained by their wider commitments. You can never go wrong. If that's one tip people leave this conversation with, you can never wrong by starting with questions rather than attacks or criticisms. Mm-hmm.
So let's flip the narrative then. Let's take a look at different categories and structures of theism. You rightly note the larger ones. Tell us what classical theism is.
Yeah, so this is just as there's many different forms and flavors of atheism, and we didn't even really get into too detailed of the different schools there. We could circle back to if we want. Mm-hmm. There's lots of different theisms, so it's important for atheists to realize that when they're critiquing theism, there's lots of different positions on what exactly that is, God, the nature of God, the number of gods, right? Monotheism, polytheism. But then even branching off from there, Mark, as you know, the various forms of religions that often but not always go alongside the theism. So just to give a few quick examples here, there's classical theism, which we've talked about on your program a number of times. Mm-hmm. This is most, you know, perhaps famously articulated and defended by Thomas Aquinas, where God is radically transcendent, absolutely simple, purely actual, so on and so forth, eternal, immutable. It's sort of the most, I would say, it's the God of the philosophers, as it's sometimes called, right? Because it grows out of perennial philosophy with roots in Plato, Aristotle, and so forth, right? But then you have what is sometimes called neoclassical theism or theistic personalism. And this is best understood as a sort of school of theism that in one way or another denies something that classical theists affirm. So they might say, well, I believe a lot of that stuff, but I don't go in for God being eternal or immutable or purely simple. Sometimes they deny one thing, sometimes they deny many things. So there's some sort of rupture or division philosophically in their conception of God from the classical tradition. I hear the music, so we can pick up the rest on the other side of the break.
My guest is my friend, Pat Flynn, and we are talking about what theists and atheists actually believe or mean. And simply, it's to say that we ought not have ubiquitous or wide-sweeping categories for both of these, but to understand where each side is coming from. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
This program brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology.
I'm Dr. Jeff Morrow. This Easter season, I invite you to join myself, the Mercedarian Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, and Father Boniface Hicks for the St. Paul Center's Easter Challenge. Together, we will gain practical insights into prayer, intimacy with the Holy Spirit, and learn how to accompany others through Christ's own example. Visit stpaulcenter.com/Easter to learn more.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore, that's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11? Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, Stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
He is honored by the church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm talking with my friend Pat Flynn, who's a Catholic philosopher, author, radio host, and we are talking about theism and atheism. Simply put, for Catholics to dialogue with atheists, we need to understand what quote-unquote flavor, a category type of atheism we are engaging. We're talking right now about the different categories of theism, those who believe in God. So, Pat, you were finishing up helping us understand classical theism.
Yeah, so the point was just to help people see that there's a range of options out there in different schools of thought. There's classical theism, which, you know, you'll find very prominently through, you know, the classical tradition. There's neoclassical theism, which is has gained more popularity these past couple decades, and contemporary analytic philosophy, which in some sense tries to deny or break with some understanding of God. In the classical tradition, often you see attacks against divine simplicity or divine immutability or divine eternity. But then there's other schools of theism. You have pantheism, which in some way attempts to equate God with the universe, that God and the universe are really sort of one being. There's panentheism, which is a really complicated school. It's sometimes hard to understand exactly what's being said, but generally it's the idea that the universe is somehow contained within God. So it's different than pantheism, and sometimes the way that that's spelled out, it actually kind of gets a little bit closer towards classical theism. And then there's, of course, you know, various forms of what might be called limited theism, and these have historical precedent, but they've become kind of popular again. And what a limited theism is a position that affirms a sort of such a weaker notion of God that I think I question whether it should even be called a theism at all. It's like mm-hmm. a sort of lowercase g God that denies that God is omnipotent or omniscient. Those are usually the two that get compromised. Some might even deny that he's perfectly good. So those positions have become a little bit more popular for various reasons. That's probably enough just to show people that there's actually a lot out there. So and people who believe in God could believe in any one of these or some option we haven't even begun to investigate yet.
So thank you very much for defining for us these other categories. And so I want to invite you to speak to, you were just touching on panentheism and why it's by itself is a can of worms. Can you help our listeners understand, I know this is a tall order, in a very overarching capacity, exactly what panentheism entails?
So panentheism is, the general claim that there's some sort of kind of unity between God and the universe. God doesn't reduce to the universe, or the universe just isn't God. But there's something about the relationship between God and the universe where we can broadly say that the universe is in God. I think if you spell this out with, and some panentheists do, in relation to a sort of causal relationship, where the universe is in God in a very broad sense, that God is present to every aspect of the universe insofar as God is bringing it into existence. This is a version that's defended in the literature. Then you don't have something that is actually substantially different than classical theism, as long as you affirm everything else that classical theists say, right? Other views, however, want to say that God and the universe are somehow kind of like one giant substance, and the universe is, in a sense, part of God. And I think that understanding is a clear break with traditional or classical theism, and I think there's all sorts of issues with that. So the point is it's complicated, and even within any one of these schools, right, there's further divisions where, you might say, okay, well, you're panentheist, and you believe this, But that could be entirely wrong, because there's, I can think of at least three or four different ways that a panentheist might kind of, you know, articulate their position. And in some ways, I think, are actually pretty close to classical theism. Others are, I think, a lot closer to like a form of finite theism or something like that. So yeah, these matters are complicated. They're tough.
Now, you also beginning to tell us about the sort of different categories of atheism that we might encounter, and what the broader picture of these categories look like.
That's right. Yeah. So you have your kind of traditional, what we would call like hardball physicalism, if we want to just kind of go through these fairly mm-hmm. quickly. And, you know, the physicalist is somebody that says whatever exists is sort of whatever the best of the hardest sciences tells us about. And typically that comes down to physics, right? So maybe it's not current physics, but some sort of ideal completed physics that will spell out our entire ontology and our epistemology of how we come to know everything that we need to know about reality comes through the scientific enterprise itself, right? So if you're a physicalist, you are a reductionist, you think everything is going to reduce down and ultimately be explained by these sort of fundamental physical entities. And of course, if you, like most physicalists and most theists, you don't think God is something that falls within the sort of methodological net of science. So it's just going to sort of land you into the default atheism, right? So atheism is the position, just to even back up and get more clarity, that denies the existence of God, right? Which tells you one thing, right? That they're committed to there's no God in reality. Again, it raises the question of what kind of God are we talking about, but it doesn't tell you a whole lot else, right? And that's what we're trying to explore now. Then there are naturalists. Right. And this is where things get a little bit confusing, because naturalists generally want to say a lot of what physicalists say, but they might be a little bit more liberal about the sorts of things they're willing to allow into their worldview. So a physicalist might actually be more inclined towards a sort of nihilism or anti-realism about morality, because that clearly doesn't fit right within their kind of philosophical methodology and epistemology and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, that a lot of physicalists do tend to come out as sort of moral nihilists or anti-realists. But naturalists might say, well, science, the various sciences, not just physics, tells us a lot about reality. That sort of gives us the best idea of the sorts of things that are contained within reality. But, you know, maybe there's still a place for various philosophical disciplines. And so we can still, you know, entertain the notion of there being moral facts and objective moral values and so on and so forth. So what you find within naturalists, again, is a sort of a wider range, if you will, of the sorts of things they're willing to allow into their worldview. And this is why many naturalists are not moral nihilists, even though they are atheists. So they keep God out. That's that. They're consistent with that, with the physicalists, but they let more of other stuff in, if that makes sense, compared to physicalists, all right? And then you will find even more, I call them sort of exotic atheists. You'll find atheists out there that will let in all sorts of things that if you were just talking to them about the sorts of things that they believe, you would assume that they are atheists, but then for some reason, suddenly they stop at God, right? So mm-hmm. I've met atheists that believe in souls, right? That believe in ghosts, that are substance right. dualists when it comes to the human person. So they kind of, maybe they privilege a scientific approach, but they don't think that it's exclusive, and they deny the existence of God, not because science doesn't tell us about God, but maybe for other reasons. Maybe because they struggle with the problem of evil or something like that. And I think that's another important thing to sort of realize, is that different people come into the different positions for various reasons. You know, not everyone is an atheist because of the science rocks slogan or something like that, right? Maybe they're wrestling with other experiences, a problem of evil or suffering or something like that. And again, I think if you're going to have fruitful conversations with somebody, the best place to start is by asking questions, trying to understand their motivations, what has driven them to the beliefs that they have, and then trying to engage them on the points that are relevant.
I'm very grateful that you brought up that sort of newer branch of atheism, that they're willing to consider the supernatural but stop short of God. How much of that is prevalent in today's culture, and does that present issues or openings to dialoguing with them about the faith?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, Marcus. So it's a minority position among professional philosophers, but it's there. I mean, I can count a few on at least one hand, a number of very, you know, serious professional philosophers that are atheists, but yeah, that believe that there's a human soul and that they have, you know, would be open to various other, what many people consider supernatural phenomena, but they deny the traditional understanding of God. In more popular culture, I think it's extremely common, right? And this is where the lines blur. I mean, you have all sorts of forms of spirituality, right, that believe in all sorts of things that more, you know, hardball physicalists would deny, you know, souls, you know, reincarnation, so on and so forth, but they deny the existence of God, traditionally understood. Your question was, where can we find points of common ground or connection to dialogue there? I think there's lots. I mean, I think people who hold to the kind of spiritual but not religious or spiritual but not theist perspective, they still feel the soul's upward yearning, right? I think that there's a lot of opportunity to dialogue with people like this, because at least in my experience, those people are very interested in spirituality, in religious questions, but there's usually some sort of holdup against theism. And one of those holdups is sometimes that they equate theism, a belief in God, with not just religion, but a particular strand of Christianity. And for whatever reason, they have an issue with that particular strand of Christianity, particular denomination. And they, because they think that these things are necessarily coupled, they feel if they accept one, they have to accept the other, and that's not something that they want to do. But again, that's one of those assumptions that is false. There's lots of people who believe in a very robust notion of God, classical theists, that are not Christian at all or not religious at all. Now, I think you should be Christian. I think you should be Catholic because that's true. But it is wrong to assume that those things necessarily go together, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Pat, always a tremendous honor to reconnect with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Marcus. Always a joy.
My guest has been Pat Flynn. He's a friend, Catholic philosopher, podcaster, author, and we've been talking about atheists and theists. In other words, to not reduce them to simple categories, but to try to understand the version of atheism and theism that they have so that we can actually share the faith effectively. I'm Marcus Peter.